Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
I'm Eamon Javers, in for Brian Sullivan tonight. Right now on Last Call, the battle for Disney's soul. It's a week that may alter the very fate of the Magic Kingdom. We'll have a special preview and a golden touch. Why the precious metal is hitting records amid the investor frenzy for stocks. 25 years in lockup. Does Sam Bankman-Fried have any hope at all on appeal? The odds here may surprise you. Bringing in the big guns, a record Biden fundraiser set to get underway in Manhattan tonight. Can Donald Trump still catch up in the race for cash? Plus, prices coming down as the EV wars heat up. Is it enough to re-jolt demand there? And call it a soft four-day work week. Wait till you see how much less work Americans are doing on Fridays. All that and more over the next hour. Last Call is up right now. Good evening here. Good afternoon out west. We'll have all of that and more coming up tonight. But first up on Last Call, a quarter to remember for your money. Holy cow. The S&P 500 posted its best start to the year since 2019. Remember 2019? It's the second straight quarter of double-digit percentage gains. That's good news. And it hasn't happened in 12 years, according to our friends over at Bespoke. The AI boom helped lift the S&P 500 to 22 record closes. Chip makers Supermicro, NVIDIA, and Micron were part of the top five best performers in the S&P 500. Investors of Constellation Energy and Deckers Outdoor also sitting pretty. Meantime, Tesla and Boeing had the quarter from hell. Both stocks are in bear market territory after dropping more than 25%. Charter Communications, Market Access, and Humana rounded out the bottom five of those worst performers. But overall, the first quarter likely printed you some money, everything from stocks to Bitcoin to gold to cocoa, hitting all-time highs. So where do we go from here? Let's talk about it with our lead-off market panel. Joining me now, Evans May Wealth Managing Partner Elizabeth Evans and Solis Alternative Asset Management Chief Strategist Dan Greenhouse. Thank you both for joining Last Call. Elizabeth, let me start with you on this question. You know, if it worked in the first quarter, is there any guarantee it's going to work in the second quarter? What do you think?
Well, holy cow is right. 10% for 3 months is an amazing return. If we were to annualize that, the market would be up more than 40% for the year. So we expect a short-term pullback, but we still think the setup over the medium to long-term is very positive for equities.
So if the things that you bet on in the first quarter, Dan, worked, are you going to bet on those again? Or do you feel like the old cliche is past performance doesn't guarantee future returns, right?
Well, it is true that past performance does not guarantee future performance. But listen, the change of the calendar doesn't do much thematically, and by much, I mean really anything, to change the thematics that have been driving the market, AI, data center, et cetera, et cetera. But even when you step away from that, there's plenty of things that have been working well in the first quarter, really over the last 6 months, that are probably going to keep doing so because they're really independent of the fact that it's March 30th or March 31st as opposed to April 1st.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Elizabeth, if you look at the sectors, you know, if you go down sector by sector, what are you looking at in terms of things that you want to pick up in the second quarter? Do you have particular recommendations?
We are less focused on sector or style box, but really looking at the individual company from a bottoms-up standpoint. So as Dan mentioned, I think you want to continue to look for companies that have strong balance sheets, are generating free cash flow, low leverage. Two picks we like are D.R. Horton and CrowdStrike.
So D.R. Horton, that's housing. CrowdStrike, that's cybersecurity. Yep. What do they have in common? They seem like very different sectors.
They are very different sectors, but there's tailwinds behind both of those. So if you look at D.R. Horton with home builders, there's a supply-demand imbalance that's going to continue to be a tailwind for the next 4 to 5 years. Plus, when interest rates come down, that should be a boost for first-time home buyers. D.R. Horton generates a lot of free cash flow yield of 6%. Cybersecurity, on the other hand, the key theme in cybersecurity today is platform consolidation. So if you look across cybersecurity vendors, there's really a race amongst those vendors to gain market share as customers look to consolidate their cybersecurity spending. So that's tripled in the last 15 months, but I still think there's more upside there. You've got the AI boom, and cybersecurity is not going anywhere.
Yeah, you know, I always say the irony with cybersecurity companies is that they depend on the continued existence of cybercrime. If they actually solved the problem, they'd put themselves out of business. But that's like cops and robbers. That's a tale as old as time. Dan, what do you think here? Do you have any specific picks for us?
Yeah, I think what Liz just mentioned, or Elizabeth, I apologize, we don't know each other, a little too formal. But I think what Elizabeth was getting at.
We're calling you Dan, not Daniel, so it's okay.
Well, no one calls me Daniel but my mom. But I think what Elizabeth was getting at is sort of the same point I was making, which is the theme and the tailwinds at work in, let's say, the housing sector remain in place independent of the calendar. The themes and the thematics and the tailwinds at work in cybersecurity are likely to remain in place for months, if not years. And so, you know, I'm making no comment about CrowdStrike or D.R. Horton or anyone else in the space. But again, thematically, those things have been working, and they're working for a reason. It's not just multiple expansion. It's not just buybacks. There are fundamentals at work in both of those spaces that are likely to continue.
Dan, I guess my question is, you know, as you look at this playing out over the first quarter, why did so many people get it wrong at the beginning of the year? There were a lot of people who were bullish, but maybe not a lot of people who were this bullish and saw this coming. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, listen, I there's still a strain of disbelief, so to speak, throughout markets. I mean, for all the talk that the equity market is getting to new highs, the broadening out, you see mid caps making new highs, the Russell is approaching its high. Despite all of that, you still hear talk, I engage in it, of comparisons to the 1990s, of whether stocks are in a bubble or not, or whether this is all artificial because of the Federal Reserve somehow. That strain of thought still remains in place. And so I think I was on CNBC the other day, and I was on with a couple of people, great analysts, great investors, I'm sure, but everything they were saying was tinged with a hint of hesitancy and reticence. And I just think that hasn't gone away, and is likely, if all is equal, is likely to keep meaning that markets continue to make highs because everybody is not screamingly bullish.
And Elizabeth, looking out ahead to the rest of the year, I mean, I just wonder if we're at this point now, you know, where with the sort of the AI boom, with the fundamentals, earnings of companies, if we are sort of like a little bit post-Fed in our thinking, so much attention last year on what the Fed would do and the market, you know, swaying with every change of prediction. Are we past that point now where we feel like the market can operate, you know, on its own momentum independent of the Fed? Or do we still have to watch and wait for whatever the Fed does later in the year and sort of calibrate our expectations for the year based on whatever the Fed's going to do?
Well, I think, of course, the Fed is very important. I think the market this year is trading less based on what the Fed and the bond market's doing. And really, when we see rates come down is anyone's guess. But what we do know is we believe we've seen the top end of the range and rate cuts are coming. So I think that there's a lot of positives as we look out to the rest of the year, and that broadening out continuing for the rest of the market to really move the market higher.
Now, Elizabeth and Dan, great stuff tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. And a reminder, tomorrow, go to CNBC.com for special coverage of tomorrow's PCE data. That's the Fed's preferred measure of inflation. Now, coverage begins at 8:15 a.m. Eastern. The markets are going to be closed tomorrow, but Morgan Brennan, Steve Leisman, and Rick Santelli will be live with the breaking PCE numbers and analysis. That's at 8:15 a.m. tomorrow on CNBC.com. And here, up next, Sam Bankman-Fried moving to appeal his 25-year prison sentence. Does he have a snowball's chance of success there? We're going to break down his odds. Plus, gold's shimmering run, why the classic safety play is soaring amid the record rally for stocks. Stay with us.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome back. Bitcoin holding steady above 70,000 today, flirting with 71,000 in trading right now. It's up more than 8% over the past week. It comes as an almost poetic irony on the day of Sam Bankman-Fried's sentencing. Since the collapse of FTX in November of 2022, Bitcoin has really rebounded, up 240%. And now the FTX founder has been dealt a long stint in federal prison. CNBC's Kate Rooney has been covering this case from the start and is live outside the courthouse in Lower Manhattan. Kate, I've been watching your coverage all day today. I saw you do a live scrum chase in the rain. I love a live scrum chase in the rain. But what's next for Sam Bankman-Fried here? Is he going to appeal?
Eamon, you're a pro in the field, so it means a lot. But next up for Sam Bankman-Fried, I saw you this week in the field, too, but it's fun to have you anchor. Next up is an appeal. So that's according to his defense team. Been talking to some legal experts about that whole process. Lawyers have about 30 days or so to submit an appeal. The oral argument for that could happen in 6 months to a year following that paperwork. The whole process could take multiple years. Judge Kaplan, though, is experienced on the bench. Those that know him say it's a slim chance of a case getting overturned here. One person put it at a low single-digit probability. There is no parole given in federal courts, but he could receive time and time credits for good behavior. One expert said federal criminals tend to serve about 88% of their sentences on average. After that, he may qualify for either a minimum or a medium security prison. All of this will likely happen in California. His parents live on the Stanford University campus where they used to teach at the law school there. We saw them today outside the courthouse looking stoic. We did not get a comment from them, but they later said in a written statement that, quote, we are heartbroken and will continue to fight for our son. This is a stunning fall from grace for the former crypto billionaire. Less than 2 years ago, or about 2 years ago, he was living in a penthouse in the Bahamas. He was really the face of this industry. And today he took the stand in a beige prison suit, pleading for the judge's leniency. The judge, though, saying that in his 30 years, he has never seen a performance, as he put it, like Bankman-Fried and his trial testimony, saying that if SBF, as he's also known, wasn't outright lying, he was evasive. He pointed to enormous harm that he did, the brazenness of his actions, his exceptional flexibility, as he put it, with the truth, and his apparent lack of any real remorse. Also said he committed perjury on the stand, which did factor into the judge's consideration on sentencing. Eamon.
Kate, thanks. Wow, low single-digit probability of success there. Sounds like a tough one for SBF. Now, turning from digital gold to yellow gold, spot gold hitting a record high today. It's up 8% year-to-date. In fact, this is gold's best month since July of 2020. Analysts expect gold to keep climbing as markets try to predict the next rate cut moves from the Fed. So let's bring in KKM Financial founder and CEO and CNBC contributor Jeff Kilburg to discuss. Jeff, explain this to me. What I can't understand about this as an outsider to the gold markets is gold is usually the thing that you have for a flight to safety. If stocks look wobbly, if you're worried about the market declining, you go to gold for safety. But we've got the stock market on this incredible tear, and yet gold is also on this incredible tear. Explain how that's possible.
Well, Eamon, it's really interesting. I think, you know, this is the original gold, not digital gold as in Bitcoin, but the original gold for many, many years, decades, if not hundreds of years, was utilized as an inflation hedge. And what we're seeing is that it's not just momentum in this. You could argue that gold is overbought. You could argue back in October it was overbought. But what you're seeing, you're actually seeing central bankers buying, accumulating this. In the event we see inflation kind of tick back up, it's been on the trajectory of coming down. But what's fascinating to see, gold at about $2,250 it's going to continue to surge higher because of the uncertainty of inflation. Some people like to approach it and saying, yes, with all the interest rate cuts, we're going to see a weaker dollar. You're going to see the price of gold go up. But I don't think that's the case, Eamon. I think it's more of an inflation hedge where people are concerned that the interest rate cutting will not happen this year, and that's going to move the price of gold higher.
Yeah, so as you look at gold, do you look at sort of inflation inputs? We're going to talk about gas prices later on in this hour, but do you look at those kinds of things that are going to increase inflation and say, well, if those are happening, that means the gold price is going up. That means I should get in now.
Well, there's been a dislocation. I think you bring up a great point. I wish I had the PCE data coming out tomorrow. I wish we had it now. But
yeah,
nonetheless,
well,
you
saw no such luck, man.
Unless you're Beaks. Unless you can do something from
right.
Beaks. But what's fascinating
orange
is that
futures.
We saw a huge dislocation in the futures market in gold. But there was a run-up back in October when you saw gold go up to 2,000 when you were talking about inflation coming down. So now, counterintuitively, you're seeing it move up potentially as an inflation hedge. But I think it's more of an accumulation. The Bank of India bought a ton in January, and you're seeing more and more central bankers gobble up the gold as it is the original. It's the OG inflation hedge.
Yeah, and you know, you look at Bitcoin too. We were just talking with Kate Rooney about the poetic irony of this incredible Bitcoin surge that we're seeing. Even as Sam Bankman-Fried is being sentenced to prison, he was the face of the industry coming out of the Sam Bankman-Fried scandal on the back of this rally. Where do you see Bitcoin going?
Well, I think Bitcoin, the real story, I know Sam Bankman-Fried going to jail for a long time is a headline, but the real story is that now the retail investor, through a financial advisor, I work with a lot of registered investment advisors, they're now allocating to Bitcoin via these ETFs for their retail clients. So you're seeing this able to allocate. We talked about that with Sully earlier, and that really moved when you saw the news of the ETF being passed. It went from 35,000 up to nearly 75,000. We've seen a ton of volatility this month, about a $15,000 range, but it seems, I know we're getting up on the April Bitcoin halving, but I think right now the momentum again in gold, all gold, digital gold, OG gold, but Bitcoin specifically is going to push it potentially up to $100,000 because of the momentum, because of every retail account with a financial advisor wants a 1-2% allocation. There's just not enough Bitcoin to satiate that demand, and it goes back to supply and demand, Eamon.
Yeah, look, I mean, it feels like the story of the first quarter is, you know, everything is rallying.
Yes.
And so you can't go wrong until you can. Something will crack.
Well, that's what scares me a little bit. You see the VIX kind of frozen at 13. So we are at a moment in time going into the Q2. We're going to have to see how this first week kicks off because we are seeing a little bit of complacency. However, if the Fed's going to green light 3 rate cuts, maybe that's not complacency. Maybe that's just simply a green light for a soft landing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Jeff, thanks. Still ahead here, the fight for the soul of the Magic Kingdom, a special preview of the week that may determine Disney's very future. That's coming up next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Forget Star Wars, the Disney Wars are heating up because in just 6 days, the Walt Disney Company is holding its annual shareholder meeting, and a lot is at stake. Activist investor Nelson Peltz is leading a proxy fight to gain 2 seats on the Disney board, one for Peltz and another for former Disney CFO Jay Rasulo. The pair say current leadership has led Disney down the wrong path. They also criticize the Disney board for approving Bob Chapek to replace Bob Iger as CEO. That was a move that lasted less than 2 years before the company brought Iger back to take leadership. Over the past 3 years, Disney shares have declined about 33%, but they've been rebounding. They're now at their highest level since August of 2022. And this board battle is splitting investors. 2 top proxy advisory firms, Egan Jones and ISS, are backing Nelson Peltz, while Glass Lewis has put its support behind Bob Iger and Disney. And just today, the New York City Retirement System said it will vote in favor of the current Disney board. It argues that the company deserves more time to enact its vision and its efforts. The system owns about 2.6 million Disney shares through city pension funds. So where do things stand in this battle for the soul of Disney? Joining me now, Yale School of Management Senior Associate Dean and CNBC contributor Jeff Sonnenfeld and Egan Jones, Senior Manager in charge of Business Development and Product Strategy, Simon Zais. Simon, Egan Jones this week announced it's supporting Peltz. Why do you think Peltz is better for Disney?
That's right, Eamon. We heard from all the parties involved. We listened to everybody's roadmaps. We listened to everybody's strategy. What we were looking for is somebody who had something specific, something articulated, and we thought Peltz came ahead in that argument.
Jeff, let me ask you this. I mean, as an outsider, I look at this argument, and I can't decide whether this is about two, you know, competing visions of what Disney ought to be, or if this is just a straight-up power struggle between two individual people. What's your take?
It's very clear. There's a genuine villain here. There's a genuine hero here. Bob Iger is the wizard.
Jeff. I mean, that's pretty unfair. A hero and a villain. I mean, we're all professionals. We're all in the industry. Wait. We're all trying to get our best returns for our money. That's absurd.
Simon, hold on. Let Jeff finish his point.
Simon, well, hold on there, Simon. No, don't be so simple. You should just wait and let me finish my point. Is your 20-page report has nothing but page numbers on it. You did no analysis. As you admitted, all you did was listen to people. You get out of the echo chamber of rumors, and you're sort of caught in this groundless gossip. He is a wizard that opens up the door of the Magic Kingdom with genuine magic, whereas Nelson Peltz is a failing financier who basically is practicing parlor illusion tricks. He's sleight of hand. You talk about his performance, Simon. You must not have done the analysis fully. And we've run this past Nelson Peltz, and he's not disputed it. 80% of his investments, 80% of the boards that he's on have been underperforming the Dow dramatically, the S&P dramatically. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal simply corroborates this, that they've been at least 4% for years under their entire portfolio. This is why he has a massive flight. 40% of his investors have left, Simon. Why do you think that is? He's had to actually shutter his UK funds. His son-in-law quit. Things aren't going well for Tran, but they're going very well for Disney, and that's what you miss here. Disney is the number one outperforming Dow stock. Yes, because what you might think are the outperformers are not on the Dow. He's the number one outperforming Dow stock. He's towering over everybody in the media business. He did last round, and he's up 30%. Where's Paramount? Down 40%.
Wow. Hey, Jeff, listen, so we got the pro powerful Iger case from you. Simon, let me let you respond to that. I mean, Jeff is calling into question your analysis. You're supporting Peltz. You know, give us the reason.
Yeah, first of all, the idea that we wouldn't do our research as a proxy services firm, that's wild. That's completely uncalled for.
Show it to us. It's not there. There's no data.
Okay. Email me after. Let's have coffee like
put
gentlemen
it out
here.
At least ISS put it out. We challenged ISS's, and they want to take it down.
You wanted our take on
Jeff,
it? Here's our take on it.
I'm
not here to tell investors whether or not Disney is a great investment, a bad investment, a mediocre investment. I can't speak. Egan Jones can't speak for Mr. Peltz. Egan Jones and I can't speak for Tryon. We certainly can't speak for Disney. What I can tell you, and what I can tell the audience, is there's presumably a reason that multiple activists have come out looking for change in Disney. They've taken a look at the castle. They've seen the cracks in the walls. They've wondered about the moat, and they've judged the king and his court wanting. The investors are looking for a change. We heard out all the players, and we decided they were right.
Simon, I'm listening to both of you guys arguing your positions, more power to both of you. What I still don't get is a sense of how this company will be different if Nelson Peltz succeeds here versus under a Bob Iger regime. Simon, can you lay out the specifics of the company?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hold on. Let me go to Simon for a second. Simon, lay out, if Peltz succeeds here, how will Disney, forget the individual performance of the individual men, talk about the company. How will that company be different under a Peltz regime?
I'll be honest with you. I left my crystal ball in my other suit jacket. But what I can tell you is that Peltz and Tryon came with an articulated vision. They had an idea on strategy. They had an idea on streaming. They had an idea on content. They had an idea on ESPN and sports. They were able to share that with us. They were able to share that with investors. We thought that idea had legs more so than what Disney brought to us. Again, I'm not here to hate on Disney. I'm not here to lay a smackdown on Bob Iger, who apparently Professor Sonnenfeld is quite close with. I'm here to tell you that after the analysis we did, we thought that the best way to drive returns for investors and the best way to drive Disney forward to the next decade was with Mr. Peltz and Mr. Rasulo on the board.
Okay, Jeff, same question to you then. The company itself under Iger, if he continues on and Peltz is not successful, how is the company going to be different in the future than it would be under a Peltz regime?
Five ways. With Peltz on the board, you have this dripping faucet that distracts you with his failing performance. He's floundering. All of his 80% of his investments are below water that on the companies that he's served on the board. What we have differently here is you have a guy who's made fantastic deals, very high returns, $16 billion of investment in new businesses from LucasArts to Marvel to Pixar led into about almost $80 billion of returns. The Fox deal was an incredibly good deal, which we could break down for you. The films, Iger has made the best films in movie-making history. 8 of the top 10 films of all box office for all times, 13 of the top 20 of all times he produced. His last year in office, he had seven
Professor Sonnenfeld,
$20 films.
I think
so
many people would
Simon,
agree with
hang
you
on
that.
There. You had your chance.
Yeah, Simon, let's let Jeff finish, and then we'll get back to you. Don't worry.
He's got a great succession plan. He has the absolute dream team from Dana Walden in television, Alan Bergman in movies, across the board. He's got five fantastic people. Plus, he brought back Tom Staggs, who ran Parks and Resorts before. And he also brought back Kevin Mayer, who did these deals and was in charge of international. It is there's no team in media as strong as this. He's also got the strongest board of any company, any public company, with the CEOs on here, Safra Katz, of Oracle, Mary Barra of General Motors. It's off the charts. The former CEO, James Gorman of Morgan Stanley. And you say you don't have your crystal ball, Simon. I think you're about 2 months on the job. And you don't have your report. You don't have your numbers. Maybe you should bring in Sean Egan to do this discussion. Sean's been a friend for 30 years. He'd have had the data with him to back up what he's saying. You're just repeating echo chambers of gossip. Get out of that and give us some numbers. Show me something right, they're going to do.
Let's not make it personal.
Yeah,
let's not make
it personal. You came out here for mudslinging. That's not what I came on here for.
Let me ask you this. We're sitting here on cable television right now, and so we have an interest in the future of the cable television industry, right? ESPN is a big issue for Disney. The future of streaming, cable, that property, and how all that plays out. Give us a sense of what the future is under Peltz. What has he told you? Where do you think that property plays out as we go forward?
Yeah, all of this is very public, right? Nelson Peltz, and again, I can't speak for Tryon and I can't speak for Nelson Peltz, but from what we've seen was a very articulated strategy of how to take ESPN, both the legacy asset and ESPN, the streaming asset, and turn it A, profitable, two, to growth, and three, move it forward with joint partnerships, ventures, and live sports and gambling. So we heard the plan. We thought it was good. Again, I'm not here to sling mud, apparently, unlike Professor Sonnenfeld, but I'm here to talk about the plans, what we heard, and where we think the value for Disney investors and shareholders lies.
Jeff, talk about cable television, talk about ESPN and that property, and sort of, I mean, all of our viewers also watch ESPN. You know, it's something that we all grew up with, this iconic brand, and it's struggling right now. What's the future?
Every single part of cable, he's got a great plan for. Disney Plus, for example, Bob Chapek pumped out too much content, low-quality content. It flooded the zone. Iger has consolidated that. They've increased the price around almost 27, 28%, and they've only lost 10% of viewers. So it's been a huge net gain. ESPN in particular, they just brought in the superstar who is from Apple, who was in charge of all their digital sports stuff. He was a McKinsey star before that. He is one of the great leaders of streaming and he's working collaboratively with ESPN, with Disney, with Fox, and with Warner. It's a great joint deal. What you just heard Simon repeat, it was It was plagiarism. It was stealing Nelson Peltz stealing what Iger's already announced as the plan. That is literally Iger's plan. They're working collaboratively. They've already named the talent. They're working with Warner, but with Warner, they're working with Fox and Disney, and they've even hired the person to do it. Simon, you better catch up on the headlines.
It seems like
Let me get one more question. Let me get questions on the substance of the business, right? Marvel, Simon, a huge problem potentially, right? I mean, that franchise seems to be, petering out. The superhero business is not what it once was. How do the films and that business change in the future under Peltz, do you think?
And again, that was another reason that we decided to go with Peltz. He had a clear vision on what was wrong with the content production at Disney. He had a point of view and was able to articulate it and was able to tell us how he plans to drive the board forward on that. You want to talk about Marvel. Since the pandemic, they've had $1 billion plus box office in Spider-Man. Before the pandemic, 6 out of 7 of their previous Marvel releases were $1 billion plus. Now, maybe that's due to changing consumer habits and box office. Maybe people aren't going back to the theaters. I don't know. Again, I'm not going to tell you what is a good or bad investment. I'm here to tell you what we heard from the various leadership teams as far as plans they had to adopt the company to the changing landscape. Egan Jones, very supportive of what Peltz and trying to put forward there.
Jeff, same question to you. Last question for this segment. Marvel and the future of the superhero movies. Are we post-superhero now, or is there a plan for the future there?
No, we thankfully just purged Ike Perlmutter, who was demoralizing the staff at Marvel that made it great. Ike Perlmutter was running free under Bob Chapek. Unfortunately, Simon has confused the time frames. You should take a look at the calendar. The years that he complained about are when the films that were developed under Bob Chapek, Ike Perlmutter and Nelson Peltz's friend. That was the disastrous 2 years. The time that he celebrated was, in fact, under Bob Iger, and that's who's back now to do it.
Let me jump in here because this is completely uncalled for.
Kevin Feige was being demoralized as well as the rest of his team. They're the ones. Stan Lee created Marvel, not Ike Perlmutter, who was a financial raider. Stan Lee built the company; it was soaring. And then Perlmutter started intimidating people, and fortunately, Iger drove this octogenarian back off to
Professor
the...
Professor Sonnenfeld,
we're running out of time here. Very quickly, last word to you.
It seems like Professor Sonnenfeld is under the impression that we're voting on whether Bob Iger should be the future of Disney. What we're voting on is the board who's going to shape the succession plan for the next Bob Iger.
Two out of 12 seats won't shape the board. They don't have a chance of getting those 2 out of 12. But in a miraculous outcome, they would at most get those two.
Okay,
they would
guys.
Be inconsequential.
Jeff, Simon, we are out of time. Thank you for a very spirited debate. Nothing personal. It's just business. Thank you, guys. Straight ahead here, Money Talks, a record-setting fundraiser for the Biden campaign set to get underway in Manhattan. But could Donald Trump have the last laugh? Stay with us. All right, let's get to tomorrow's news tonight. A major fundraising event happening tonight in New York City. It's at Radio City Music Hall in Midtown Manhattan. And former Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama are joining President Biden in an all-out fundraising effort. His campaign touts it as its biggest ever. But Donald Trump may have a trick up his sleeve come next week. Joining me now, Puck News founding partner Teddy Schleifer. Teddy, thanks for being here. I really appreciate your insight tonight. You're so good on the money beat. This is going to be a massive, massive fundraiser at Radio City tonight, right?
Well, look, Joe Biden has the advantage of having the former presidents of his party want to show up at a fundraiser with him, which is not something that Donald Trump can say of the living Republican presidents.
I can't remember a time when we've seen three U.S. presidents at a fundraiser simultaneously. Maybe unprecedented. We'd have to go way back to find an example, I think.
In fact, I don't even think Donald Trump could get his own former vice president to show up at a fundraiser for him.
That's true.
Biden clearly has an enormous financial advantage heading into at least the middle of this year. Trump, I think, is actually doing pretty well at making up lost ground. I mean, he has an event next month where he's going to kind of try to collect lots of, frankly, early money to him. People who have not supported him during the 2024 campaign to date, who are accepting reality. He's the Republican nominee, and there are lots of people who feel that they've got to support him. Otherwise, they're going to be politically irrelevant. So he has his own event that he claims will raise $30 million or so. We'll see what actually happens.
The big question with the Trump money, though, as you know so well, Teddy, is, you know, how's he going to spend it, right? I mean, Biden is going to spend this money on campaign staff, TV ads, all the typical stuff you spend it on to get elected. Trump is going to spend a lot of this, maybe most of it, on legal fees.
Yeah, I mean, look, Trump has been trying to find a way where he can cover the, you know, these obviously escalating legal bills that are not going away anytime soon, while, you know, trying to bring into the fold lots of major Republican donors who explicitly do not want to fund that, right? I know there are, yeah, you know, there are Haley supporters, let's call them, you know, anti-Trump or Trump-hostile Republicans who I think are willing to bite the bullet and support the Republican nominee because they don't want 4 more years of Joe Biden, but will only do so in a world where they get to actually spend the money against Joe Biden, which, you know, there's going to be some creative campaign finance engineering the Trump campaign is going to do to try to make that possible. But
yeah,
clearly,
we'll see. Teddy, hey, thanks for your insight. Tonight, by the way, tickets to this event start at $250. They go all the way up to $500,000. I think neither one of us be able to afford to get into that room tonight. But thank you for your insight. Let's get to our Quicker Than the Ticker feature. All the best of the rest of the headlines.
Let's put 60 seconds on the clock. The rich getting richer thanks to the year-end stock rally. The wealth of the top 1% in the U.S. hit a record $44.6 trillion in Q4, according to the Fed. A Salesforce Guinness World Record is taking the title for the largest ever gathering of people dressed as Albert Einstein. Einstein, of course, the mascot for Salesforce's AI tools, cost the company $20 million to license Einstein's likeness. From one world record to another, 25-year-old American Lexi Alford just became the first person to circumnavigate the globe in an electric vehicle. It was for the Charge Around the World competition. And Hollywood history sold. The infamous wood panel that saved Rose and not Jack in Titanic sold at auction for more than $718,000. Still think there was room for two on there. Punxsutawney Phil's got a new job. He's a father. Phil and Phyllis recently welcomed two healthy baby groundhogs. Congrats to the happy hogs. All right, coming up, the EV price wars heat up. Even with lower prices, will they go far enough to re-jolt demand? That's coming up next.
Welcome back. Let's get to our last call watch list. And tonight we're watching gas prices ahead of this holiday weekend. Wholesale gasoline futures are now up more than 30% so far this year, up nearly 3% just today. According to the Energy Information Administration, retail gasoline prices have jumped nearly 11% since January, a major three-month increase compared to the same time period last year. Now, when retail gasoline prices only rose 2.6% at that time. And while gas prices are on the rise, EV prices, they continue to fall. Chinese smartphone maker Xiaomi has announced it will sell its first EV at a starting price of $30,000 in China. That's $4,000 less than its main competitor, which is the Tesla Model 3. The price is so low, Xiaomi's CEO even acknowledged the company is selling each car at a loss. The Chinese EV market is so flooded, automakers have few other options to try to break into it. Things aren't much different here in the U.S. EV prices rapidly moving closer to the industry average, which is dominated by gas-powered cars. But just how much lower can EV prices go? With me tonight for more on this is celebrity motor car owner Tom Maioli. Tom owns several dealerships across New York and New Jersey. Tom, thank you for joining Last Call. And my question to you is, what do you make of this Chinese strategy? I mean, you can sell cars at a loss, but you can't make up the profit by selling volume, right?
No, I mean, good to see you. But I have to tell you, it's a race to the bottom. I've been calling for this. You know, Fox News just did a montage on me that I've been calling since 2023 with 10 segments where they did this whole montage where I've been calling for an EV crash and it's here. You know, the EV market has burned over $100 billion. Manufacturers are throwing money at this crazy concept that the Biden administration put out there. And the reality of it is it doesn't matter how low the prices are go. It's going to... We have another 20 to 30% that we could go down, but it doesn't matter how low they go. The demand is not there. The consumers don't want it. Hybrids are selling 4-to-1 over EVs. And, you know, listen, I would not want to be Elon Musk. I mean, obviously he's not missing a meal, but he's down $40 billion in stock. Tesla was down 12% today. They continue to drop their prices. You know, Dan Ives of Web Business Securities came out and said, code red on Tesla. You know, they're in a bad spot, and the whole EV market's in a bad spot.
Yeah, look, I mean, differentiate, though, between the Chinese market, where there is this cutthroat competition because you have these Chinese automakers, and the U.S. market, where you really just have the traditional automakers with their individual EV plays and Tesla. I mean, in China, there is no question there's a glut, and that's why you're seeing them sell cars at a loss. They're not selling those Chinese cars, though, here in the United States.
Well, you know what? It's coming. And I'm going to tell you why. What they're going to do is they're going to end the round. And, you know, President Trump called it. You know, if you listen to President Trump when he talks, he called it. What they're going to do is they're going to go around our trade pact and they're going to start manufacturing these cars in Mexico. And you know, if they manufacture them in Mexico through our trade pact with Mexico, they can bring these cars in illegally and they're going to flood our market. And it's happening as we speak. They're already building factories in Mexico. And watch out, U.S., because I'm going to tell you, BMW, Mercedes, Lexus, Toyota, all these companies that are out manufacturing these EVs and trying to keep up with this crazy mandate that the Biden administration put in place, they're going to lose their shirt. They're all losing their shirt. Ford just cut 10% of their workforce in their Lightning factory because they can't sell these trucks.
Yeah. And Brian Sullivan, who anchors this show most nights, says, you know, people don't necessarily want to buy an EV. They want to buy a Tesla. And the rest of the e-market is an afterthought. Tom, thanks for your insights. Really appreciate it. Straight ahead, kicking our feet up like never before. The eye-opening new data around Fridays in the office. That's coming up next.
I think moms, well, especially moms, we are able to balance so much in life. And that ability to balance actually makes us really good leaders. I could be on a conference call, my kids could be barfing on the side, and I have to stay still and say, let's look at the projections and financials. And quite frankly, we just need more women.
Welcome back, everybody. People are working less on Fridays than they have in the past. That's not necessarily a bad thing. According to workforce analytics firm ActiveTrack, employees are signing off nearly an hour earlier on Fridays than they were back in 2021. With me tonight for more is the Muse founder and author of The New Rules of Work, Catherine Minshew. Catherine, thank you for joining Last Call on a Thursday, not on a Friday. Explain to me what you're seeing in the data here about what's going on in the workforce.
Yes, it's very interesting when you look at the trend across the last few years, because as everyone just saw in the graph you shared, we are seeing individuals start to log off earlier, especially on Fridays. At the same point, underneath that top line trend, which I'm sure might be surprising or even worrying to some folks managing large teams, there's a lot of other things going on, right? We're seeing this interesting tension between productivity and work-life balance, between employees and employers. And in fact, many companies that have done studies of worker log-off times, working remotely, are finding that many employees are actually making up the time that they may not be putting in on Friday on other days of the week.
But if I'm a boss, I look at this and I say, hey, wait a second, I'm paying you for the whole week. You got to work the whole week.
Well, I think that one of the big questions here is, are we paying workers for their output, their sales, their creativity, their ideas generated, projects move forward, products or code written, or are we paying them for time spent at a desk? Again, underneath this data, it's really interesting to see that a lot of workers who are logging off earlier on Friday are actually taking fewer sick days or fewer days off in general because they're able to balance work more effectively during this weekend time.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're exactly right when you talk about work output. But a lot of what we do is sort of social. We've got to brainstorm with our colleagues. There's some FaceTime with the boss stuff. For the younger workers, it's about watching and learning. We kind of lose a lot of that, don't we?
You know, I think that that's something that, that companies are grappling with right now. I've seen some businesses that really investing in, specific in-person time versus every day in the office, or even remote team building. And I think others that perhaps are just sort of leaving it to their employees may be seeing a reduction in those, as you said, those micro conversations that build culture and share ideas in between teams.
Catherine, I'm just looking at your backdrop right now. Are you working from home right now?
I am working from home right now as we speak. I'm a poster child for it.
And it's Thursday.
It is. You know, I think that I do love spending time in person, and I try and make sure to prioritize it sometimes. But for me personally, I don't need it every single day to be my most effective. And I
think we're
seeing the
data. I will expect to not see you in the office tomorrow, Catherine. Thanks so much for your insight. Really appreciate it. And do you guys know what happened 25 years ago tomorrow? A major milestone for Wall Street.
Monday, March 29th, 1999, the day that will be remembered as the first time the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed above the 10,000 mark.
That is the great Sue Herrera, formerly CNBC anchor. This is how it looked on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange after the closing bell. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani was throwing Dow 10,000 hats out to traders. Look at the arm on him. Of course, the Dow would continue to cross other big milestones. Now it's within striking distance of 40,000 on the Dow. Great to see Sue Herrera back on CNBC, even just in a clip. That's your last call for tonight. Markets are closed tomorrow, but Brian and Last Call will return on Monday. So until then, I can say we can.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.